first dealt with the Spartans. We also recognized the National Merit Finals as well that night.
Yep.
There's two presentations tonight, both from Ms. Perkins, one on the estimated, the tax cut and estimated revenue expenditure, which is a bit of a bring down, I think, from, you know, it's kind of a, an update from what we presented last time.
Yes.
And an explanation of the fiscal stress indicators, and then at the next meeting we'll have an idea of kind of where it plays out in terms of that fiscal stress.
And I thought it was important, I asked Carol to talk about the financial stress indicator first. So I don't know if that was first on the agenda.
Yeah,
but I thought it was important for her to talk about that, because a lot of what we do, you know, with regards to not wanting an operating deficit, and what we're going to talk about when we talk about surplus and things of that nature as we go on, it's so important to see where we are with our financial stress. Mm-hmm. I know the boy knows where we're at right now, but that position that we're in, that's one of the reasons we're very careful with our budget, not making sure that our expenses, right, are not greater than our revenues, because that becomes a tremendous problem. And remember, when they look at it with, and correct me if I'm wrong, Cal, but when they look at it with, as a financial stress indicator, they take out your applied fund balance. So we apply approximately 1.3 million, mm-hmm. right? Around there, yeah. Right? Each year, 1.3, 2,
two one.
Right? 2.1, there you go. So we apply that, but you've got to take that out of the equation when they look at your financial stress. So it's really important to understand that we do not, we want to look at our operating expense, and we want to make sure we're very careful. And this is why our next presentation should be set. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
I hope it does. So go ahead.
Okay. So we have the fiscal stress indicator, and the reason why New York State put it together, the controller's office, was it's a system designed to provide early warning of the fiscal stress of a local government or a school district. We provide the state with financial information every year, and also our financial statements are provided to the state. They analyze it, and they use it towards the stress indicator. Also, it's a tool to provide stakeholders such as yourself the ability to look at the financial conditions of the school district and then make your decisions accordingly. So there are four categories of the fiscal stress indicators. One is your year-end fund balance. Second is the operating deficit, third cash position, and fourth is the short-term debt. So with the first category, year-end fund balance, they look at two things, the unassigned fund balance and the total fund balance. And the unassigned fund balance is used, it's the 4%, you can't exceed the 4% of your current year's budget. And that is used, it's like a cushion in case you have unanticipated expenditures, or if your revenues, there's a drop in revenues for whatever reason.
So let me ask a question on that. We see in the news today that 28 schools or something have been, you know, targeted by the controller for being above that.
Right.
How did they drop the ball there and not be able to calculate 4%? Like, what are they doing? Are they just blatantly ignoring it, or?
I believe many of them. If you go over 4%, you knowingly go over 4%, because it is written in law that
right.
Especially if you do it multiple years.
Yeah, and if you do it multiple years. One year, but multiple years, yeah. A lot of districts feel that they need a large rainy day fund, and that's how they explain it. But if you read, I guess, the statutes, says 4%.
So I asked the question, how are we comfortable that we're not going to show up in Newsday when the controller does an audit of being over 4? Is that simple, 4% of the total is the math?
Yeah, because what you do is when you calculate the 4%, when we know what the, like say this year, we know what the 18-19 budget will be
right.
At some point. And so when we closing out the books, we would take 4% of the 18-19 budget and not exceed that.
That's simple.
It's that simple.
And we were just audited, right? What was the most?
Right, we just had an audit, right. And we just had a state audit, and they looked at all of our reserves, and they had no problems with any of our reserves.
So
then that leads into total fund balance. And the total fund balance is your unanticipated fund balance, the 4%. It's your appropriated fund balance, which is used to offset the tax levy, and it's your reserves. And the reserves are those funds that we set aside for specific purposes. The second category is, as Mr. Stewart mentioned before, is the operating deficit. And the operating deficit is when your expenses are greater than your revenue. And that is not a good situation to be in. Your revenue should always be greater than your expenditures. And again, the fund balance, anything that we apply, is not included as a source of revenue. The next category is the cash position. There's two different indicators, the cash ratio and the cash percentage of monthly expenditures. What it looks at is how much cash do you have on hand? Can you meet your bills each month? And each category is pretty much the same thing. Looking at your cash compared to your liabilities, and then looking at your cash and can you meet your monthly expenditures? Is your cash greater than your monthly expenditures? And that's where you want to be. The last category is use of short-term debt. Two indicators are short-term debt issuance and short-term debt issuance trend. Short-term debt is could be RANs, revenue anticipation notes, or TANs, your tax anticipation notes. And every year we go out for a TAN, and most districts in Suffolk County go out for a TAN. So every year, a lot of times our scores include the TAN. We go out every year for a TAN, and they look at the issuance of the TAN. Okay, so then the next is the scoring. And what they do is, again, the state goes through all these fiscal stress indicators. You get points as you go through. And then they determine that there are four categories. Significant fiscal stress, which is 65 to 100% points. Moderate fiscal stress, 45 to 64.9. Acceptable, 25 to 44.9. And no designation, 0 to 24.9. And as you probably recall, usually around November, December, the state comes out with the designations. Newsday has an article, and they usually mention who's susceptible who has a moderate, who has significant fiscal stress. Those who have no designation do not appear on the paper. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see that the reason why Seven Ridges is not in the paper is because we have had no designation for the past 5 years. And you can see that beginning when we started doing this score in 2013, we had 23.3% as a score. And last year, 2017, we had 13.3%. So right now, we are in good financial shape. And so as we go forward, we continue to look at the score.
How tight would we be able to get this at our next meeting, or the meeting when we finally say, here's the budget that we're approving, as to the number that the state will find us for next year?
I could go through and probably get a pretty good idea of where we might be. I mean, sometimes there's, when you end up at the end of the year, maybe your cash is a little bit less because, we all...
Ballpark 1 or 2%? I mean,
yes.
If you could show us that when you present, when we have the final budget presentation, that would be great.
Okay.
And if it's something, if we go up, from the 13.3 based on your estimation, just kind of point out to me, hey, we went up because, to pay, whatever, we're getting our revenue late from Eastern Riches or, however it is.
Okay. Okay. So the next presentation from the board tonight is the overview. 2018-19 budget, tax cap, and revenues and projected expenditure. This is the third presentation for the 2018-19 budget. We had one back in January for the enrollment and staffing projections, and then the administrators presented in February. So I want to start off with the tax cap. And we've gone through every year we go through the tax cap because it's important, you know, because it deals with the tax levy and how do we get to the tax cap. And every year we hear about 2%. Why isn't it 2%? Because going back in 2012, when Governor Cuomo came out with this in the legislation, they mentioned 2%, and it's just ingrained with everybody. Everyone thinks it's 2%. But there, what I'd like to tonight talk about are the factors that go into the tax cap and why it may not be 2%. So the first thing is part of the calculation is they take into account the growth factor for the school district. And the growth factor is the new construction within the school district. And the Office of Real Property and Services, they do the calculation and they provide it to each and every school district within the United States. So that's a factor. Another factor is the capital exclusion. The capital exclusion is taking into account the debt service of the school district, offsetting it by building aid, and that's factored in because every district has different debt service. Every district will have a different calculation for that. The next is the pension exclusion for the employee retirement system, teacher's retirement system. They look at the rate. If there's 2 percentage points higher, then that's included as part of the calculation. And last but not least is the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. And that's what, when I spoke about the 2%, that's what really they focused on was the Consumer Price Index. And you can see that over the years, there's actually only 1 year, 2013-14, where the Consumer Price Index was 2%. 2016-17 actually went down 2.12%. This year it's 2.13%, which is great. However, we can't go over 2%. So we have to use 2% in the calculation, even though the CPI just used 2.13. So the next slide, and I'm not going to go into the mechanics of the slide, but it's a representation of how we go through the calculation of the tax cap, where we end up, the bottom line is this year we have a 2.57% tax cap, which includes 0.66% for the capital project. And if you go to the next slide.
Well, can you just talk about that for a second?
Yeah. And I think the next slide might have much of that shows a little bit better, is that with the debt service or the capital exclusion, it's important to note that they pull it out. When you start the calculation, they look at the prior year tax levy, and they pull out the debt service because they don't want to include, you know, when you have the growth factor, they don't want to apply the growth factor to the capital exclusion. So they pull it out. We go through all the calculations. We take the prior year tax levy, we apply the growth factor, we back out the capital exclusion, apply the growth factor, and then we apply the CPI. And then at that point, we add back the debt service or the capital exclusion for the upcoming year, 2018-19. So it's important to note that there is no CPI, there's no percentage increase on the debt service. It's separate.
But the reason that we're over 2% is because when you add it back in.
When you get it back in, it brings it up to over 2%. It was.
Take it out, your main number in 2017-18, 22,653,881. That's your number, that's your baseline. Then you take it out, then you add 2% approximately. Then when you put it back in, you've added 2%, but you need to put that number back in.
Right.
And you have an extra 66%.
Right. That's correct.
Why is that number, the 936, greater than 913?
Again, it has to do with the debt service schedule and the building fee.
Okay.
And it varies each year. So, the next slide is the actual overview of the tax levy limit, the tax cap and the tax rate. Back in November of 2017, I had a presentation about this, so I'm not going to go into detail. Again, all this presentation will be on the district website, so if you want to look at it in more detail, if you have any questions, you can call my office, and I can explain it in more detail. But this is just an overview, and it shows you, like, if you look at the first line, it shows you that there's a variation from year to year. It started off in 2012-13, 2.95, 2014-15, went down to 1.18, and right now in 2018-19, the calculation is 2.57%, which again includes the capital project.
So the board goal is that not that we go out with the max cap, it's that we actually prudently grow with a portion of the income. So
yes.
Take a second.
Right, because we have the 2.57, and then on top of that, we would have to look at the goal of the board, which is 1.5% and a 0.5% for growth in the program.
Actually, it would go 1.5%.
Right.
Then you would add the 0.66,
right,
and then back it out to 0.41. The 0.41 we can only do if we can show growth. It cannot be something that we already did exist.
Not this contractual programmatic increase.
Exactly.
That one and a half.
Exactly. So that would have to, we'd have to show that if we went out with a 2.57, our budget would have to show a 0.441 growth.
Yep.
So then so are there any questions on the tax calculation at all? So then we'll move on to overview of 2018-19 revenue and expenditures. So we'll start off with the estimated revenue for 2018-19. You'll note that there are three components of the budget. State aid, tuition, and tax levy, they make up the majority, for the budget. And we've already discussed the tax levy of 2.57% or $23.2 million. The next category would be state aid. State aid, we're estimating $12.3 million. And where we calculated that was back in January, the governor came out with his proposal, and his proposal included this $12.3 million. And what that entails is the foundation aid and any expense-driven aid, such as transportation, your high-cost aid, your BOCES aid, your building aid, things like that, is included under the governor's proposal for state aid. So that's the number that we're using at this time. However, when the legislators prepare the budget and finalize the budget, which hopefully is on time, which is April 1st, should be approved, typically the legislators apply more state aid. So that's why right now it's subject to change, but we're using the governor's proposal at this point. The next source of revenue is tuition. And tuition right now is estimated at $5.4 million. And tuition comes from three sources. It comes from East Meridian's tuition, Native American tuition, and special ed tuition, where we have students from different other districts attending our special ed program. Now, you see that there is a decrease of 101,000, but that has nothing to do with the with incoming students. What happened was last year when we prepared the estimated the revenue for the 17-18, which is this year's budget, we overestimated. And so this is certainly more in line with going forward. And then the other sources of revenue or interest, we have a year health contracts, which are those health services that we provide to the private and parochial schools, students from other districts attend schools, and we go out those services. We have other income, which includes going to replace, rate, rentals, book collections, insurance recovery, all those things are included in other income. The reserves of 121,000, that is the employee retirement reserve. We use 121,000 each year for that reserve, and then we apply the fund balance of 1.2 million, and again, that's used to offset the tax levy. So overall, the estimated revenue for 2018-19 is $42.9 million. Then we go on to the proposed expenditures for 2018-19. And the first category of expenditures are salaries. There's a decrease of $497,000, and that is due to contractual increases from the collective bargaining agreements. Equipment, there's an increase of $10,200, and the increase is due to things such as vacuums, replacing the vacuums, the building and grounds, digital cameras for our curriculum, and the replacement of some of our musical instruments. Each year we try to replace them. And moving on to contractual, there is a $250,000.
Transportation.
Okay. Transportation, there is an increase of $83,464. And it's really based upon fluctuates because it's based upon the demands of the school district. For example, this year, unfortunate family, they were displaced. They were considered a homeless students, and so they were living outside of the district. And the new district have to provide transportation. So that's an additional cost.
So you should know. So that increase of $83,000 is directly related to the homeless population. It's not just one. There have been several for different reasons who are considered homeless. We have to provide transportation if they're living in Patchogue or in Riverhead, wherever they are. We always try to use shared services, remember that. So if there's a possibility that we can tag on with another bus from another school district, we do that. It doesn't always work out. But just so you know, that additional $83,000 right now is based on the additional homeless students we got this year and the way we're looking at it for next year.
Well, you guys did a great job in negotiating with Attleboro.
Yes.
Yep.
And the rates that we pay, apples to apples, the rates that we are paying are actually less year over year, yes?
It's
with Attleboro?
It's a 0% increase.
Right. Did we get more impacts as well?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That is
true. Yes. That's included.
So the increase,
every year the give back
increases
as we go forward.
Okay.
Right now we're attributing that to the current situation.
Yes.
Several of them that we have right now we can't control.
Okay.
Okay.
Next category of expenditures is contractual, and there's an increase of $215,965, and there are several factors that contribute to the increase, one being the 5-year maintenance plan back in September. Mr. Kelly Kelly has presented a five-year maintenance plan, and so we factored that into the 2018-19 budget. We have Mr. Ryan, who has been our claims auditor for I don't know how many years. He decided to going to retire this year. We had to replace him with an auditing firm, and so that increase is included. We have insurance increases, services to support IDPs. There's an increase in utilities such as water.
The ability to bid our insurance and stuff at nicer always.
You have the ability to go out with a commercial insurance, but nicer is nicer does a really good job of protecting the interests of the school district.
Any districts use anything other than nicer?
I have to.
Let's just look at it. I mean, and obviously, it's not for this budget, but let's look at it. Let's understand what, you know, five or six similar situated districts do with their savings. Let's understand the issues.
Sure.
It's almost similar to the you know, the insurance.
Same health insurance.
Same exact thing. Majority, we happen to be in the majority, without a doubt, with NYSA.
And
but there are others that use individual insurance, and we can certainly have a presentation.
And with NYSA too, they understand school district will certainly look, but any claims that we've had, they fight, and they don't give it up. They don't, and they will fight until they win. and a lot of times they do. Moving on, supplies, an increase of 57% supplies, and that has to do with we have the science room in the elementary school, so additional supplies are needed to set up the curriculum for the science program, and replacement of student chairs and desks at the elementary school, and plan operation supplies, and then supplies to support the instruction program.
I just want the board to know we're still reviewing, as we got to here, we're still, you know, 6 to 8 weeks away at this point in time, but we want to let you know we're still reviewing to see the necessity of any of these things. When Carol mentions furniture, that's not furniture for the science rooms. That is furniture for the entire school.
Yeah.
Some of the supplies they need for the science lab is under this code, though.
Yes. Okay. The next category is tuition. There's an increase of $115,500, and that's primarily due to special ed placements that are IEP driven.
Out of our control.
Out of our control,
IEP driven.
Yes.
And are these things that we can look at to do ourselves and pop an IEP at some point or not?
Absolutely. It's something that we continuously look at. It's something we continuously look at. Determining the appropriateness of child placement. Sending a child out of district is one of our last resorts, but these are IEP-driven, they're committee-driven decisions that, unfortunately, we do not have control over at this time. But it is something that, as a committee, you have to revisit continuously throughout the year.
Okay.
Next category is textbooks and workbooks. There is a slight increase of 10,000. Decrease in posting services of 11,000 to 52, and debt service of 15,100. And that's based on the debt schedule. And
we anticipate, like, as we go out from TANs, interest rates being higher as they're in a rising interest rate environment. How do you think about that?
It's factored in to when we look at that expense for TANs, that's factored in.
It is. So do we have a TAN expenditure line in here, or is it assumed somewhere else where we think that's going to be higher next year? Or is it?
What we have right now is sufficient if there's an increase.
Okay.
But it's in the calculation.
It's
how you calculate.
Yes, it's in the calculation.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay.
And there's some standard that they say this is what you should assume the interest rate will be?
Yes.
Okay.
And then we have employee benefits, an increase of $316,478. That increase is primarily due to the teacher's retirement system, or the employer contribution to TRS. Went from 9.8% to 10.63%, which is this year is the first year in many years where we've seen an increase. For the past several years, you've seen a decrease, and this year, fortunately, there's an increase.
Okay.
And then health insurance, we're anticipating a 10% increase in health insurance.
So the 360 is DRS, ERS, and health?
Yes.
Okay.
And so for a total budget, $43.4 million, and a percentage increase of 3.04%.
Which means that?
At the 3.04 is the budget. The budget. Last slide will actually show you overall, all put together.
Okay. So the last slide is the gap we have right now between the revenue and expenditures. And if you look at the slide, your estimated revenues are 42.9. Your proposed expenditures right now are 43.4. And we have a gap or a shortfall right now of $504,830.
And last time, just remember, we were here. We were at 960 at that point in time. Now we're at 504. And like I said, this kind of evolves as we move forward. Right now, this does not include retirees. Right, it doesn't include any additional money from New York State aid, which we expect to get more. How much is to be seen? It doesn't include anything with accessing due to enrollment, of course, because enrollment is going down. If you access, it's not in here.
There's no accessing in that 504?
No.
So just to really sharpen, to put a sharp point out, we're $504,000 short. With the program that we've got, given the increases that are kind of inherited in the contracts and what we need to do for busing in the program, without any growth?
Well, the only thing I would say is that's not exactly true. There's a few things in there that you saw, like Teachers College.
Yeah.
You saw $10,000 for that. That's additional. That's growth. The things we took out right now we have the tax levy limitation of 2.57. Last time we received in 40, we weren't sure where it was going to be. We kept it at 2, just to be sure. We had a comprehensive independent review, as you all know, by our auditor. Our auditor, per your request, we had the auditor to come in. The auditor looked through everything very specifically as far as our surplus and made some recommendations under the areas of salaries, under the projection for salaries. And we went to the 100,000 to the good in that area, which helped us out. So between those two, we had a new truck on there.
Meaning on the salaries, meaning because of where we are and how where we are this year and the way we calculate, the budgeting that we're doing for the next year is a touch higher than we need to be.
It was.
So we bring it down by
100. We brought it down.
600 to 500.
Exactly what we did. There was also a new truck in there at one time for the maintenance department, although the truck is still good. Every year I think we go through different ones. If we're able to help out, we'll do it. But that was in there. And we accomplished, although this board accomplished some of the five-year plan. If you remember, early on in this year, when we were doing well in certain areas, the board approved like the lighting, the outside lighting, you know, some of it, some extra cement work. There were things that had to be done. We did it for safety reasons in some of the areas, but some we were just able to do at that time. So we've kind of been chipping away from that as well. So between all of those, we brought it from a 960 to a 504.
Okay. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thank
so,
you.
So bring us to the next section of the agenda tonight. While Carol's still standing here, does anybody have any questions on that? Do you have any questions on what Carol just presented?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much, Carol. So, just in the interest of time, we'll take questions on what's on the agenda tonight and or items not like we talked through the agenda pretty quickly, and we've got a number of items to discuss the exact other questions.
Could you speak it out?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, no. So, I'll try to read. It's pretty awesome. So, I just wanted to come talk to you guys tonight about something that had happened with my daughter that's in fourth grade, and she's 10 years old, and there's been a few things over the years, but it's been kind of handled on the building level, and it's, you know, bullying type related, and as many of you know, I work as an education advocate at Long Island Advocacy Center. I advise families all the time about FAFSA, the All Students Act, and what to do, and I know what to do, but I've been kind of like, let's just see how everything goes, you know? Like 2 weeks ago, my daughter came off the bus, and her sweatshirt's all dirty, and she looks kind of upset, and I was like, Kendall, are you okay? And she just starts crying, and says, how was school? And she says, terrible. And I said, well, what happened? She pulls up her shirt, she's got a good-sized gash, like a burn type of thing from the concrete. And she pulls up her knee, and it's all bruised. And I said, what happened? And she mentioned the student's name that's been kind of liking her since the beginning of the school year, and, you know, known of a couple of things with this particular student, and some kicking and hitting that's happened with this student, as well as a couple of the other students that were involved, and that apparently purposely pushed another student into her. She slid across, like, no, that already slid across the cement or whatever. She, while she was down there, you know, whatever, crying, whatever, she went to the nurse's office, she was there. Nobody called, you know, and I never got a phone call about it. So I was surprised when she came off the bus like that, and I was like, okay, that's it. I'm like, you got to come in the car with me. So we went up, and I wanted to see Mrs. Hardwick, and she was in a club, and I said, well, let me see the DASA coordinator. Nobody in the office knew what that was. They didn't even know what a DASA coordinator was. And I said, could you find out who it is? And so it's the vice principal, right? So I go down, and he goes, oh, you were my next phone call. Meanwhile, I was waiting in there, and I saw the nurse, and I'm like, why didn't you call me? I don't understand. She goes, oh, well, I sent home a note, you know, and I said, but look at this. I'm like, my daughter was kind of hurt. You know, there's no Neosporin. She said, well, we can't do that. I'm just the sub. And I'm like, okay. So I go down to speak to the DASA coordinator and, you know, just had a conversation with him, and I just said, you know, I just wish I was called, because my daughter's like, why isn't my mom getting here? Like, what's going on? Type of thing. And, you know, like I spoke to the DASA coordinator, and Ms. Harper called me after. Everyone's really great about once they know, you know, like everyone calls you and they're communicative and they want to try to help you, and that's fine. Like I told them, I don't want to see these students punished. Along with this boy, there's been another situation with another girl that multiple times, like, will body slam my daughter into a wall or push her, and her head will kick back. The teacher handled it. I talked to her about it. My daughter was also thrown from her sweatshirt by the same child onto the concrete, as well as another boy. They kind of dealt with it, and I hold back, and I'm like, I don't want to do the formal process. I know what it should be. But then it's like, and again, I don't like suspension. I'm glad that we don't default to that all of the time. I don't agree with suspension for some kids. I don't know what their situation is. I don't know what their family history is. I'm very sensitive to that. I feel like school is sometimes the only consistency they truly have, and they need this, and they need to not be out of school in a lot of situations. Or there's situations that maybe we're seeing a pattern of behavior. You know, please do the child find, send them for the psychiatric evaluation, do whatever you have to do to get the counseling, being proactive. So it just started thinking about this whole thing, and then talking with other people and hearing about bullying. And then I did have a conversation, which I'm sure some saw on Facebook, where I was like, because they were talking about implementing the code of conduct, and I had a couple parents contact me off list that told me that their child was so upset with what they saw that, and I don't know these parents, that they went back and reported it to the DASA coordinator, I guess, preparing before I got there. Come to find out that while my daughter was down on the ground crying, the boy was dry humping her and saying that her ouch looked like a hickey, and has told her about, I guess this boy does this a lot with hickey stuff. So again, don't know the history of the child. It's concerning. Definitely want counseling, want things like that. Again, I'm not a fan of suspension. I'm just not. More restorative type of justice, which is what DASA is, right? So going back to that, I was looking at, and that's why I wanted to come tonight, just to get it off my head a little bit and throw it out there, looking at the Board of Education policy related to DASA and the regulations related to DASA and our code of conduct, that the Board of Education has to review our code of conduct and see how it's being implemented and what's going on and whether there needs to be changes. one of the things that I noticed is it doesn't look like we've really implemented the piece where we're supposed to include DASA in our code of conduct. So I just would like to suggest that we take a look at that again. And one of the things that I would love to see, and I don't know if this could be possible, but you know your subcommittees that you do at the Board of Education, your health and wellness committee, you have like six committees, I think I want to say. You have the health and wellness, you have the curriculum instruction, you have the grounds. I would love to see another committee added of a DASA committee or something so that we can include, even if it's a forum where you have students that have been bullied or students that were the bully or whatever, where we can start having more conversations directly with everybody and participate to maybe take a really good look at this. You know, I was just looking through, like, again, like our code of conduct and some of the presentations, and I thought, you know, it was interesting that I was actually... This piece about school employees who witness harassment, bullying, and/or discrimination, and receive an oral report of such act shall promptly, orally notify the principal, superintendent, and then within the next day, it's supposed to be actually be a written report type of thing. This type of language is actually in William Boyd's code of conduct. Under the code of conduct, where it says like the personnel's responsibility or school staff compliance. So it's taking these actual regulations that are, I think that's probably, I'm not an attorney, better with this kind of stuff, but that's where those regulations related to DASA are supposed to be incorporated in our code of conduct, as far as staff responsibilities and having a clear understanding of what that is. The other thing is, yes, so it says a school district DASA policy must be adopted by Board of Education, included in the code of conduct. This part I wanted to bring to your attention, and it's a thankless job anyways, you probably didn't really care if you got taken off, but apparently students and parents can make an appeal to the commissioner that would allow the commissioner of education to remove a trustee, member, or board of education, and certain school officers for willful misconduct or neglect of duty, and that was related to not being included in the code of conduct. And I just was thinking that might be a connection to something we might want to take a look at and try to correct. So that's it. And everyone, you know, Ms. Hardwick has contacted me and all of that other stuff. I get a little bit concerned with, you know, as far as mental health and making sure there's counseling going on and all the restorative things that DASA is supposed to do. And again, I hesitate with the DASA because I don't want it to result in a suspension situation for a child necessarily, but maybe if we know that DASA is not about a suspension process as much as it being restorative and what we can do about that, the counseling and the action plan, because that's what it's supposed to include when you do those reports, that I'm supposed to be entitled to an action plan and what's gonna happen to make it better, or if the victim needs it, or something like that too. Teachers who try to help. My daughter's actually really resilient with things. She's very, you know, good with that. She's very understanding of behaviors and differences because she has a, you know, brother with severe autism, so she's very, you know, good with that. And I'm, you know, hoping that she's not doing anything herself, but it's, you know, I know it can happen. But I just wanted to talk to you guys about that and maybe take a look at that. And again, I would love for the consideration of another committee related specifically to DASA, since it's such an ongoing conversation, and maybe we can pick through things and help present it, because you guys have so much on your plate anyway about some, you know, possible importance.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I'm also now, but I want to come before, why I came out in this weather, is because this is an issue that I've felt passionately about for a long time. And that is the issue of gun violence, especially in our schools. It's a highly emotional one, and the most prominent emotion being fear. Because, of course, every parent's worst fear is something happening to their child. However, fear, no matter how justified, is an emotion that often causes us to react in irrational ways. When implementing public policy in a school setting, it is crucial that while we acknowledge and absolutely sympathize with the fear, we understand that the policy itself has to be based on, first, the healthy development and productive education of our children, two, the actual facts behind the issue, and three, what we hope to achieve and how we can most effectively achieve it. Two great educational psychologists, Jean Piaget and Eric Erickson, analyzed how children learn and the learning stages we all go through as we become adults. Piaget believed that children took an active role in the learning process, acting much like little scientists as they perform experiments, make observations, and learn about the world. As kids interact with the world around them, they continually add new knowledge, build upon existing knowledge, and adapt previously held ideas to accommodate new information. We've all had the experience as parents of being amazed by our children and the things that they know that we don't even remember teaching them, or the way they so exactly mimic ours and other adults' actions. We all see how true it is that they are little sponges, absorbing the world around them as they observe everything in minute detail. Eric Erickson dealt more with the psychosocial learning phase of the children. According to Erickson, the ego develops as it successfully resolves crises that are distinctly social in nature. These involve establishing a sense of trust in others, developing a sense of identity in society, and helping the next generation prepare for the future. The first crisis he phrased as trust versus mistrust. And the basic virtue created by the successful meaning of this crisis was hope. That, to me, is the crux of this debate. As grown-ups, it's our duty to provide our children with hope. Hope that we will be there to take care of them. Hope that they will learn to take care of themselves. Hope that they are capable of carving out a place for themselves in this world, and hope that they have the power to make it a better place. When grown-ups don't surround our children with these hopes, but instead surround them with a world driven by fear, we do ourselves and them a grave disservice. In 1981, a year before my first child was born, Adam Walsh was abducted and murdered. In his grief, Adam's father, John, became widely known for his work concerning abducted children. In fact, only about 100 children, a fraction of 1%, are kidnapped each year in the stereotypical stranger abductions we hear about in the news. Despite this fact, as I raise my children, I frequently heard parents in stores and other public places admonish their children to stay near them or someone would take them. My children's generation led much more restricted childhoods than my generation had due to the irrational fears generated by the greatly expanded news cycle and sensationalism of crimes. Irrational because factual large decreases, not increases, of violent crime over their lifetime. Children need trust and hope, not fear. Perhaps, and this is only my conjecture, the episodes of school violence we see now are an outcome of that fear that children see and hear too much of nowadays. When one is afraid, it can be natural to strike out before you're struck, to see people as others or as less than human, because everyone is to be feared and no one is to be trusted. As parents and the grown-ups in our society, we must not allow ourselves to give in to our own fear so completely that we ignore our profound duty to provide our children with trust and hope. The facts behind the issue of school shootings and gun violence are conflicted and often polarizing. I have read a great deal on the issue and have brought a few articles with me that I'll give to you, read just a few quotes here. James Allen Fox, the Lippman Professor of Criminology and Law and Public Policy at Northeastern University, states, "For all those who believe that schools are under siege like never before, it is instructive to take a statistical road back in time. Whereas five of these incidents have occurred over the past 5+ years since 2013, claiming the lives of 27 victims, 17 at Parkland, the latter half of the 1990s witnessed 7 multiple fatality shootings with a total of 33 killed. For the Safe Schools Initiative report, researchers from the Department of Education and Secret Service studied 37 incidents of targeted school-based violence. They found all the attacks were committed by males. 98.5% of the attackers experienced or perceived a major loss prior to the attack. 75% of them had a history of suicide attempts. 71% felt persecuted, bullied, threatened, or attacked. And 95% were current students at the school. The report also cites some red flags that can be paid attention to. With all these things in mind, what do we want to achieve, and does hiring armed guards effectively help us to achieve it? We, of course, want to keep our children safe and provide them with a great education in healthy, nurturing environments. Hiring armed guards, however, is a concrete display of fear, one which our children, as learning sponges, will absorb and incorporate, and one which could ultimately corrode their sense of trust and hope. If we're willing to risk this grave loss of hope, then I believe we must be quite sure that this action would at least effectively keep them safe. Clifton Leaf, in a Fortune magazine article titled, Why Aren't Guards at Schools Won't Work, states, as the argument goes, we put guards with guns and banks to stop thieves, so why not use the same strategy to protect our children? After all, we cherish these young lives far more than we do our bank deposits, don't we? In fact, banks hardly use armed guards at all anymore, because they found that the presence of armed guards tends to dramatically increase the likelihood of violence and injury during robbery. A 2013 report from the National Crime Victimization Survey showed that in 99.2% of the violent attacks in the United States, no gun is ever used offensively. In conclusion, I fervently oppose the hiring of armed guards in our school district. I know we all want the same thing, to keep our children safe. But we must also think about the profound cost of doing so. Once trust and hope are eroded, can they be restored? Do we want our children and ourselves to be ruled by fear? Do we want to enact policies and hiring practices in reaction to exaggerated and distorted statistics, such as over the past quarter century, on average, about 10 students are slain in school shootings annually, compared to the more than 100 school-aged children who are accidentally killed each year riding their bikes or walking to school? Is it more effective to take the shorter route of hiring armed guards, or the longer route of training our teachers and school personnel to be aware of the warning signals and the red flags, and provide them with the resources to truly help the child and the family? It is our duty, our most urgent duty, to provide our children with trust and hope so they can be prepared for their future.
Thanks, Linda. I appreciate you coming to say that, express your views. We heard views from many, as you know, but you and I discussed and talked about this at length. And, you know, I think that kind of the prior comments and the board meeting will express kind of where we've been on it and the viewpoints, but I certainly appreciate very much hearing where you are on it and the discussion.
I didn't read anything about, what does it look like? Does it literally look like armed guards, or is it something more like on the airplane where you just know they're there?
A bid. We put out a bid publicly to get quotes from services, third-party services, for an armed guard. I want to be very specific about what we as a board, you know, discuss and what we're comfortable with. But for as an armed guard, in each building, the intent is that that person be an off-duty, active-duty police officer.
So people would see them and know who they are, type of thing, as opposed to being completely like written up. You've got one and they know where they are. Like, why would you even say?
So hold on. So an off-duty, active-duty police officer is what the RFP is out for, or a bid is out for. To your question, we talk a lot about that. Is this someone that is out in public that everybody knows there he is, or is it someone that we don't know who is the armed guard? We're not talking about every security person being armed. That's not the...
I'm a cute lady on the corner of the
page. No, that's not the thinking at all. And, you know, I can't go right now into a lot more depth on your question around where will they be or how they be for security reasons, which is what some of it we talked about in exec. You know, I mean,
okay.
To have a public hearing.
Sort of general understanding a little bit.
But the takeaway has generally been, listen, we've got two things right now. We have SROs, which is a school resource officer, police officer. Suffolk County police officer who's in the building on a regular basis. It's been going on for years and years and years. I'm here for a variety of purposes. The purposes are really to provide education, to provide counseling and support, and to act as a law enforcement official. They come in uniform with their active duty police. We also have off-duty police officers working in security roles without being armed. We've got a number of them that work a variety of hours. I don't know if we know the hours each day, each week, who are not armed. So the conversation that we've had is we're comfortable with, and the district's comfortable with, an active duty on-duty police officer in the building with a firearm. It's been supported forever. Personally, I feel more comfortable when I see a police officer. It doesn't instill, oh my gosh, why is he or she here? What should I fear? That's a personal thing. I get your point, Wendy. We've talked a lot about that. Is a kindergartner going to be made to feel afraid by seeing them? But we also said, well, now we've got these off-duty security officers, off-duty police officers providing security. What is the difference between that person, if he or she is on duty in a blue uniform, or off-duty in a red jacket? And I think part of the conclusion we've come to is that's the same person. That person is a well-trained, currently active, certified police officer. And if you're comfortable in the SRO realm, and that person's not here all the time, perhaps be more comfortable, in the other side. So that's about as much as I can say. I don't want to say where we're thinking of necessarily stationing the person or, for the security reasons. Is that answer your question?
Have you
received
the bid yet?
No.
So you don't know what figure that
we
is?
We don't know the cost
yet.
Right. We don't know the cost yet.
So, just one other quick problem that, aside from the fact that at Parkland, if there was an armed police, active duty police officer there, I know of one, I heard three, but for sure what? They didn't help. It's, in my mind, it's the same kind of thing as you inoculate your children because you don't want them to get the measles or mumps or whatever. You want to get it before it ever gets to that point. So if you're talking about spending thousands and thousands of dollars per school for one person, where is the equivalent of that to admit that before it gets to that? Because in every one of those cases, it's in front of the kid that's had.
So it's I violently agree with what you just said, and we've done just that. So we've added a social worker in the last year. We've added a social worker.
So high school, middle school, and elementary, or just one at clubs?
One FTE.
That clubs.
It ended up that person doesn't flow, but because of that, a person didn't have to flow.
And then we added a director of guidance. So that is the director of guidance for the district. We put a person in place to manage that. So what you're saying is exactly right. Can we inoculate in the first instance? Can we address these mental health issues before they come to me?
So that you put your brief example that there's a kid in the elementary school that's talking that the girl that he just knocked out. I mean, that sounds to me like there's some issues there.
What you're saying,
I guess why not mental health counselors, not just social workers? Because it's two different disciplines.
Everything is multi-layered. Right. You got to think about it from that standpoint. So when we talk about security, if we had an outside consultant, an expert, a group come here last year, look at our entire security here at Santa Cruz Schools, and then they made multiple recommendations to make our schools safer. Some are very costly, some are not. In the same, the way you look at it, the same thing with the social emotional piece. It's multi-layered. It can consist of our character education, and I know you all probably know quite a bit about extensive character education programs we have, especially at the elementary school.
No.
You don't?
No.
You should certainly sit down and solve this.
I know they have an intervention level, this purposeful play thing that they're doing.
for some of the kids.
I would tell you, the purpose of play, what I would say is, there was an entire Board of Education presentation on this issue with them, so I would recommend that you go onto the website, you'll be able to see what we do district-wide, social, emotionally. You're absolutely right. When you talk about... the purposeful play that you talk about, you're absolutely right. It is, and I appreciate that, because that is something that's new, and as to your point, it's another layer of the social and emotional piece. So when you look at the comprehensive tariff education program that you have, it addresses the social and emotional needs of children, whether it's through the psychologist, whether it's through our DASA, whether it's through our social workers. All of those things are part of that. It's hard to weigh, do you put a fence around the school district or do you add something else with regards to professional development for the staff with regards to the social emotional. So we kind of lay that all out.
I'll just add this, and my own experience with this was years ago when our house burned down. My older one was in second grade, and she did see the school psychologist once a week just to, because there was no help out here. 5 years ago, there weren't family practices like there are now. But I know that this was a wonderful lady as a social worker, but I'm wondering if we are paying attention that they are skilled in these particular areas. That's my question.
Yeah, what was the last part of the question?
That if they're skilled in how to recognize and how to deal with and how to help the child
yes, and we have absolutely a trained staff in many of these areas. We went into detail in our presentation, but the answer is yes. And exactly what you said, again, you are absolutely right, that years ago, they didn't have the outside help, because the outside help is essential now.
The ones who called never called me back.
Is that right?
That's it.
I can tell you the ones that you speak to, Ms. Fabian in here, Mr. Trujillo and company, they're incredible here. They do a lot of work with the Bridges in the know, working closely with Kathleen Johnson and Ms. Wicks. So the connection between all of them, whether it's with MYO and our enrichment program, there's so many areas and we need to lock arms, all of us. It's not just, if you talk about counseling for your child,
yeah.
We've had a couple of house fires here, and I think the way there's community rallies around those families is second to none.
I think it's great, too, that the community center is going to be right next door, so that if there are programs within the school that are starting to recognize things, that they can work in conjunction with community centers for an outreach. I mean, these are all things that I feel way more strongly than spending money on our part.
No, I agree with that. At the end of the day, important for sure. Absolutely.
Because there's going to be an either or.
Yeah. Well, remember, and in our social, the social and emotional piece, remember, you're talking about our family. Sometimes we have involvement with outside of our family, and I would say security is probably there most because of what could come from the outside in. Although, number one priority, right, is here to take care of our students as they go out of society. And the other is to decide, and I know there's different feelings about this, of how to protect our children when they're here.
But the facts have to be paid attention to, and with 95% of current students, they're not people just coming in from the outside and posting in. That's a huge percentage of the students are already here.
Yep.
So is there training going on with those specific facts and acknowledging those specific and the red flags and the...
Yeah, we have presentations.
And obviously need more
help. Yeah, I think you probably know about us from being some of the staff conferences at the beginning of the year. We have presentations all the time.
I know,
you know, like with the DASA presentation, you're still missing DASA. We had our entire staff, we do it every year, which is interesting. So we have...
accepting piece coming.
The
Sept of PTA with that Nicholas to do a whole thing on DASTA. And that's where those slides I was reading, I actually got from Jeremy's presentation as well as the attorney's presentation. I just want to say that, like, in the board, I guess you guys get yearly reports about our DASTA from the building principals, because they're supposed to. They're supposed to provide you with their data trends related to the bullying in the schools, right? So we get those yearly that we can access. Because I just want to say, on the NICEF website, I mean, just knowing, you got to remember where I work. So I know a little bit more than I should as far as some things with bullying and things that happen. But like the 16-17 school year, you can go on the NICEF website, it has the data for the DASA reporting. For our elementary school, as far as found DASA reports, there were zero. For the middle school, there were four. Mm-hmm. And the high school, there was 19. That just doesn't seem realistic to me in light of my own experience with my own children. It just doesn't seem realistic to me that the staff is doing their due diligence and they're supposed to report when they see something and the report is supposed to be made up. So it's not just about parent reporting. It is actually supposed to be reported by everybody. So I think that would help drive some of that system to make sure that people don't get fallen through. That's the point of these regulations, is not only to, it's not to be like ahas, it's to follow a pattern and see if there's a pattern of behavior that would warrant an FBA or warrant a psychiatric or warrant, you know, those types of things to make sure that those mental health needs are met as far as the child fine obligation goes, you know. And again, some of these kids, I get it. I went to presentations about that before. Trauma-informed care, I've talked to Jeremy Thode about before. I love that whole practice, restorative justice. You took some of these kids and you took 45 seconds of their entire life and you saw a 45-second video clip of every horrible thing they've ever witnessed, you might have a better understanding as to why their behavior is how they are. And I believe that. So, again, I don't want to be upfront. I want to try to help you a solution with this stuff. And
no, I think that, but remember, like, today we had a leadership conference here, right? You were all involved in that and got to see exactly what you're talking about happening in the entire high school led by students. Mr. Nickwitz did a fabulous job. As you know, I was there, right, as well. I love Mr. Nickwitz years ago, by the way. They're all layers. All of these things are layers. I absolutely agree with you. But they're all layers.
So the number one most important thing for the school district is safety, whether it's safety from a mental health perspective, safety from
sexual assault,
safety from drugs, from alcohol, from depression. We're moving that ball and we're focusing in all of those areas. Sexual harassment training across the board.
Vaping.
I mean, there are so many different things that, in my view, attack our kids and can attack our kids and that we need to be careful about. How do you do it? You start from the bottom up in the mental health, working with them, and the training. So I really feel that whether it's, you know, you look at security, what are the 13 things you can do to be perfect? What can you afford to do? How do you do it? It's the same on the other side. How can we fix the mental health issues, address the mental health issues, make sure that each child moves along in the right direction, regardless of how they are at home, to your point? So it is a constant effort. Can we be better? Of course. Everybody can. And that's what we look at constantly. How can we be better? And how can we spend our money in the best way to ensure safety across the board? And all of the things you're saying are things that we talk about, things we think about. You know, as we see things come up, as we see, you know, different types of issues arise in the school through various reports that we get to see, we talk about it. Are we training enough? As we see things in life, we talk about, are we training our kids on sexual harassment? What does it mean? We talk about, are we properly disciplining our kids? Because it's a hell of a lot better to be disciplined in elementary school or high school than it is to be locked up for doing something when you're out. So it's all of that. And the armed guards are a piece of that puzzle. Whether or not you agree that it is the fix, it's not the only fix, but it is something that may help, and that's the conversation.
And
while
you were talking about that, it's a budget.
We've talked about it, Wendy, for the last 3, 4, 5, 6
months. But I mean, as you get more feedback, there's a budget item, correct?
Yeah, and it's
so
a
bit. So before it's adopted in April, we'll roll up.
Yeah, April, I believe it's off the top of my head, I say April 11th is our board meeting. I'm going to say it's adopt that. The bid comes in on March 14th. You can call the Wendy. I'll certainly give you the numbers. It'll be public, in fact, at 3 o'clock. If anybody wants to come watch the bids, very exciting for Carol, right, Carol?
Mm-hmm.
You can come watch those bids.
First, yeah. We're going over some of the training aspects, what you're doing in, as far as the inoculation.
That's not the point of that for me. We've spent an inordinate amount of time over the year through the presentation. Right now we're in our budget cycle. The board has discussed that length and has agreed.
But that's not on the 21st. I'll be able to ask you questions to see how those costs are ending up.
But I'm saying the costs, absolutely.
Sure.
Any other questions?
Yeah, this will just be my last thing. My only other thing is that if we don't get the data reporting right, if we don't get that data about the baseline data about the amount of incidents and everything like that, how are we going to know if the trainings and this and that are actually effective if we don't see the numbers going down? So that goes back to my point of the DASA being implemented into our code of conduct and teachers and staff, secretaries, everyone knowing that if they see something, they're supposed to orally report it and it is supposed to be written, and then we have that data so we can have a true sense of what's really going on. That's only my concern. For me to not get a phone call, I'm telling you, if I did not go up to the school, I know for a fact that I would not have gotten a call. I know for a fact. Because my daughter's been throat punched before at school where she went to the nurse's office. This was in second grade. By a student that I know has some things going on, so I didn't make a thing. But I was never contacted, and I didn't make a thing of it. So I know what happens, and I know the data is not being reported. So it goes back to we can check off the check. We're doing this training, sensitivity, we're doing this and this, but we don't have the true data about the incident reports. And it's so important that we have that so we can see it goes down. Just like purposeful play, where's the baseline data? Or when I did a Parents as Partners for helping kids learn how to read and kindergarten, love to volunteer. I have an ABA background because my kids, so I was able to make data sheets and make it more database. But there is no database in our RTI, and that's, you can't make arbitrary whatever decisions without the data to show that the data. That's my only criticism, I would say, for some of it's where I see a deficit that could get better.
Thank you very much. Understood. Anything else on the other side? Okay. In light of the time, unless anybody has a specific objection, I'd like to go through the budget and motion to adopt the minutes of the regular meeting, February 7, 2018. Motion. Second. All in favor? Yes. Motion to adopt items 6 through, I don't see my favorite thing.
It would be 6.
Why not have the calendar on it?
6 through 22.
6 through 22 of the published agenda, the revised published agenda. Motion. Second. All in favor? Yes. Motion carries unanimously. So on this, as noted at the beginning, Tom Kelly's resignation has been accepted. We want to thank Tom for his many years of service to the district and wish him the absolute best in his duties at that. Motion to go. Oh, and there's an additional addendum. Motion to adopt item 26, student trip, recommended action upon recommendation to attend the school. The board has been approved. The robotics club to attend the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute Robotics Regional Contest in Troy, New York on March 15, 16, 17, 2018. Is there a plus with that? No.
There's always
other than the substitutes.
Yeah.
Motion. Second. All in favor? Yes. Motion carries unanimously. Motion to return to executive session for purposes of discussing a pending issue with the CNCA. And what's the rest of the session? Purposes of discussing personnel issues and salary issues for two units within our district. Motion.
Motion.
Second. All in favor? Yes. Motion carries unanimously.